WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I've been in the news business for a few years now, and here's a statistic that I found interesting. I'm not blind to the fact that TikTok is a thing, a huge thing, but a third of American adults under 30 regularly get their news from TikTok. That caught my attention, to say the least. I came across that figure in a piece by my colleague Claire Malone, who covers media for The New Yorker. And Claire writes this: more and more voters are forming opinions based on the funny video that their cousin's husband's sister shared in the group chat. In other words, whether I like it or not, memes matter. Claire Malone joins us now. Claire, one of the quotes in your piece just stays with me. A right-wing influencer says the following: the left can't meme, but we can. What does that mean?
It basically means the left is too self-righteous and sanctimonious and worried about being politically correct that they can't be funny. But the right wing can be funny and go there. They can say the things everyone thinks but doesn't actually say out loud. I think that's what he means there.
I see. And is he right?
I think there's some truth to it. Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that there's one of the reasons why, you know, I talked to this professor, Ryan Milner, who studies memes. He's an academic memologist. And
you can make a living at that?
And he basically said, you know, like, the reason why right-wing memes are so successful is because in American right-wing ideology of 2024, it's a very black and white thing, right? You know, fluid gender identity is a total joke. We all know that. That's the right-wing thinking. So we can make the funny joke that, frankly, probably elicits a lot of maybe inappropriate laughter from people who consider themselves Democrats, but they wouldn't maybe make the joke themselves. But I think the right wing has, what's the phrase we all like to say, has created a permission structure for that kind of humor because it is a more black and white ideology. This is how America should be. This is how it shouldn't be.
So let's start with this meme of Biden's birthday cake and other age-related memes.
This is a picture of Joe Biden that was posted on his Instagram. He turned 81 in November, and it is a birthday cake absolutely alight, engulfed in flames.
It looks like a forest fire on top of a chocolate cake.
That's right. And Biden is sitting there smiling at a glossy mahogany table. And the caption says, "Turns out on your 146th birthday, you run out of space for candles." Okay.
Okay. That's all in good fun.
Basically, the Biden campaign has realized that he will not get younger. And so the way to deal with concerns about his age is to make jokes about it.
That joke is showing up on Joe Biden's official Instagram account, right?
That's right. Yeah. So that's their way of sort of counteracting some of these, there are a lot of memes on the internet of Joe Biden tripping over his words or maybe looking confused. The RNC actually put an ad or a YouTube ad that sort of spliced them all together. I think those are a little bit unfair. I mean, one, Joe Biden suffers from a stutter or has kind of overcome a stutter throughout his life. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's some of that going on with his speech patterns. But yes, there are various things beyond just the Biden tripping on the internet that makes him look old or fumbling or feeble.
A recent poll shows that 77% of American adults think that Biden is too old for a second term. So is that meme helping Biden?
I think it's, I should say, with those poll numbers, it's also a majority of Democrats or a plurality of Democrats. I mean, most people think this he's too old. I mean, I think it's...
Trump is a spring chicken of what, 77?
He's 4 years younger than Biden.
And looks fabulous.
I think we're dealing with an American public that is upset. I would say that both of their candidates are...
of an age.
Old. Let's use the word, David. Old by any standard.
So online, we're not seeing left-leaning memes at all when
we
it comes to politics?
We are. You know, I think the most prominent one, which I do talk about in the piece, is the Dark Brandon meme.
So explain what that is.
Okay. It's complicated. So it's a dark Brandon meme is a left-wing meme derived from the right-wing meme, Let's Go Brandon. Let's Go Brandon is a polite way of saying F Joe Biden. So the Dark Brandon meme sprung up on what we call dirtbag left mm-hmm. Twitter. And it was basically anytime Joe Biden got sort of a policy win early in his administration, sort of to counteract the feeble narrative of Joe Biden, these guys, and they're mostly guys, would tweet out images of like Biden in his aviator, but with lasers coming out of his eyes, or like Emperor Palpatine hands shooting out thunderbolts. And it was basically like, he's not a doddering grandpa. He's this sort of powerful dark lord who gets it done in Washington. And the campaign now sells T-shirts of the Dark Brandon meme.
Now, you say that the right does this better. They're better at memes, or at least your source did in this piece. And at the same time, there seems to be memes all over the internet about Trump's affection for fast food, for example.
So I think the sort of famous meme is when he invited the Clemson football team after they won the national championship. They came to the White House during a partial government shutdown.
Right.
And so Trump on, you know, Washington silver, served them McDonald's, Domino's, just like a host of fast food. And there's an amazing picture of him with his arms outstretched, basically.
So that meme works for him, not against Biden.
I mean, it was sort of affectionately. There were certainly, you know, liberals who made fun of him on Twitter. You know, people have been making fun of Trump for his bad eating habits and appearance for a long time. But then people on the right were like, you elitist. This man is in touch with the pulse of America. People like fast food, and so does Donald Trump. And like,
you might not have a pulse after that meal, but you can. It's relatable, as they say.
It's relatable. And he leans in. He knows that he is a figure of, he's a caricature, and he knows that.
I mean, he plays with it.
Yeah. And in fact, if you look at when he was booked and had his mugshot taken, right, he had that sort of famous glowering to the camera picture.
Which he apparently rehearsed.
Yes. and I think we could all tell that.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of, it is an amazing visual representation of our time. And Trump tweeted it out himself.
So it became a meme for him everywhere.
It became a meme. I mean, it was basically then made into T-shirts. Sure, people on the left wing made fun of him, but Trump knew that was going to happen. He knew it was going to be the news of the day. And he very cannily asserted his own control over it and gave—
And his outlaw cred.
Exactly. His outlaw cred gave his supporters basically signal to them, this is how we're going to handle this. This is going to be our line of response
to
this.
So is the meme format uniquely effective at taking something that in the old sense would be bad coverage and turning it into a positive?
It can be. I mean, it can spin both ways. It's memes are basically like the updated political cartoon, right? I mean, you know, so...
Which barely exists anymore.
Which, you know, yeah, here.
No. I mean, political cartoons used to be a staple of what used to be called newspapers across the country, and everybody had a Herb Block or a Tolls or whomever, and it's a smaller tribe now.
I think that there, you know, you can be hurt by memes as a politician, as I think Biden probably is.
Do any memes ever end up hurting Trump, or is he just immune from that because of the nature of his, I don't know, his persona?
I think he is probably hurt by them to a certain extent, but to a lesser degree, a much lesser degree.
Which one's than, hurt?
I do think, well, let me back up and say that I think it's all impacted by polarization. So I do think there is a slice of people who are ambivalent about whether or not they're going to vote for Trump. And I think you could, for some of those people, the memes of him, you know, the mugshot, or when Trump sort of, you know, is talking back to the Manhattan judge, or, you know, making sort of puerile statements, like those are things that I think can go out into the ether. And some people will say, you know, if they're a supporter of his, look at this guy. He's like really sticking it to the man. It's mm-hmm. a witch hunt. And other people will be like, geez, this guy. I mean, is this really what we, you know, the accumulation of bad stuff is going to happen all over again if we reelect him. And by the way, when I reached out to the Biden campaign to ask for their response, they basically said, you know, our internal polling shows that most, you know, target voters, that's what they used.
And what does that mean?
It means basically, I think, like independents who are potentially swayable towards Biden.
In crucial states.
Yes. Well, they didn't specify, but I think we could probably infer that. Most of those people think, aren't sure that Donald Trump is going to win the Republican primary. And the implication there was, once they do realize that he's going to be the nominee for president, there's a good likelihood they're going to get sick of him. And it's not so much a defense of against Joe Biden being old so much as a, well, people are going to be annoyed by Trump again, and they'll forget about how much they think Biden is too old for office.
In the Quinnipiac poll, he comes out 6% ahead of Trump in the popular vote. Now, that's yet to be confirmed by other polls. We'll see how this matches up with others. It's polls themselves, as we've learned to our absolute devastation.
Or how they do in swing states.
How they do in swing states. It's a momentary phenomenon, to be sure. But this is the first poll that he's had that is at all encouraging to the Democratic Party in a very long time. Does humor and memes have any effect on voters, do you think?
I mean,
it's okay if we're just having a good time.
I mean, my theory about American politics is, especially in the past, you know, decade, is basically none of it's really policy. It's all political pheromones. You like the cut of the person's jib. You kind of like, yeah, that guy. And that's really what it's all about. So if the person parries back with humor that you like, and it seems to be done well, and it's not corny, then maybe it works.
Or vicious,
yes.
Oh, that's baked into the brand, too. I hate to combine two cliches in one short sentence. Let's turn to something much more important than the 2024 election and the stakes of democracy in general. Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce. Now, this romance has become a kind of cottage industry of conspiracy thinking. What has been showing up online, and what are the key memes there? Let's just take it really low here. I mean, enough with this high-minded stuff.
This one I didn't actually see this one coming, which, shame on me.
Exactly.
Basically, the new conspiracy theory is that Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift's romance is a Democratic or maybe deep state operation to win Joe Biden the presidency, because if both of them endorse Joe Biden, then it will be
unfair,
I guess, a coup. It will, you know, the idea is basically like the NFL and Taylor Swift are, you know, along with complaining about airlines, the thing that all Americans can get behind.
That noted left-wing organization, the National Football League.
Right. Right. But this was going, I mean, this wasn't just like a meme in like, you know, weird right-wing Reddit.
It was on Fox. It's been on Fox every night.
Yeah.
Dark Brandon doesn't get bogged down on details. He can't name a Taylor Swift song. Taylor Swift can't name a Biden policy. This relationship was engineered in a lab. And Taylor's boyfriend, sponsored by Pfizer, it is a match made in corporate heaven. Could you imagine if the Chiefs win the Super Bowl?
Does any of this mean anything? Or is it just, you know, a little bone for us to chew on for a while?
I think it might be a bone for us to chew on, maybe some Super Bowl promo.
And here we are chewing.
And here we are chewing on
like
it.
Mad, yeah.
I mean, I was just, Ross Douthat had a little thing in the New York Times, and I think he made a pretty good point, which was basically Taylor Swift has endorsed in an election before. She endorsed in the midterms in, I think, 2018, and her candidate lost, you know. So it's not necessarily, I mean, again, Tennessee is a deep red state, and that's where she sort of made a very public endorsement. But will Taylor Swift swing in the 2024 election? Hey, okay, maybe not. But maybe, you know, Biden is sort of unappealing to younger voters. Maybe if Taylor's, I don't know,
she's
getting out the
shy.
Vote in Wisconsin.
Is there any history of a celebrity endorsement having a decisive impact either in the era of memes or before?
I don't know. I want to say, like, maybe during the Obama era, but that was really more like certain political influencers in the primary kind of said to, like, to vote to black voters in particular, it's okay to vote for him. Like, you should.
Oh, but John Lewis
shouldn't be right.
Was
he's not.
Not
I'm
a
not like. Was,
as
no,
such.
I know. But was I'm trying now. I'm trying to, and you know better than I. Like, was Oprah so
well,
early
that's
so
that's
early to Obama that it was influential?
God, it's going to be a long, long campaign. Claire Malone, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, David.
You can read Claire Malone's column on the media and politics at newyorker.com. The Supreme Court is hearing oral arguments in a case that could have tremendous impact on the presidential election. This is the Colorado case, deciding whether Donald Trump should be eligible to be on the ballot in the state of Colorado. The plaintiffs, who include a 91-year-old Republican, argue that Trump should be disqualified because of a clause in the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. Jill Lepore, a historian and staff writer for The New Yorker, joins our podcast, The Political Scene, this week to talk about the history behind that amendment and the stakes of the case.
The reason this case exists is that Republicans in the Senate failed to do their constitutional duty and convict Donald Trump of impeachment in January of 2021. And I think that's really important to remember. The proper way to deal with the insurrection on January 6th was indeed to impeach Donald Trump, which the House did, and then the Senate, by a very narrow margin, failed to reach the two-thirds majority, right? It has now come out in several memoirs that some of the, I believe it was 10 senators that were needed to convict Trump, were persuaded to vote against conviction because of threats against their families. And Mitch McConnell said, of course, at the time that he voted against convicting Trump of impeachment because he thought this was a matter for the criminal courts. That was the wrong decision, right? Trump should have been impeached and he would have then been disqualified. The criminal prosecutions that are now proceeding very, very slowly are, you know, another way to confront the problem of a president who has engaged in insurrection. But this is not the best solution.
That's Jill Lepore speaking on The Political Scene, a podcast from The New Yorker. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. What is it about Dana-Farber that makes it such a powerful adversary against cancer? It's hundreds of Dana-Farber researchers and clinicians making new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber discoverers. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, nothing is as effective against cancer as a relentless succession of breakthroughs. Go to danafarber.org/everywhere and see how what we do here changes lives everywhere.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In 2018, the New Yorker published an essay about reckoning with the death of a mother. It was called Crying in H Mart, and its author was Michelle Zauner, the musician who fronts the band Japanese Breakfast. It was a lovely essay, and she kept writing and writing and expanded the essay into a book finally, a memoir about culture and family and loss and food. A lot of food. People say they got hungry reading her descriptions of cooking Korean dishes with her mother. Crying in H Mart, the book, spent over a year on the bestseller list.
H Mart is freedom from the single aisle ethnic section in regular grocery stores. They don't prop Goya beans next to bottles of sriracha here. Instead, you'll likely find me crying by the banchan refrigerators, remembering the taste of my mom's soy sauce eggs and cold radish soup, or in the freezer section, holding a stack of dumpling skins, thinking of all the hours that mom and I spent at the kitchen table folding minced pork and chives into the thin dough. Sobbing near the dry goods, asking myself, am I even Korean anymore if there's no one left to call and ask which brand of seaweed we used to buy?
That's Michelle Zauner, reading from Crying in H Mart. At the New Yorker Festival recently, Zauner sat down to talk with the New Yorker's Hua Xu. And it was really a meeting of minds because Hua also wrote a memoir called Stay True, which won the Pulitzer Prize last year. Both extraordinary books. And here's Hua Xu speaking with Michelle Zauner.
Michelle, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm very nervous.
No, you're not.
I am, yes.
He was like eating a Rice Krispie treat like right before we went on. I was like, wow, you're so chill. Like walking up the stairs with a Rice Krispie treat.
I can't believe you told everyone that I did that. the book, which I'm sure everyone here has read, Crying in H Mart. I guess I'm contractually obliged to ask you whether people recognize you at H Mart.
Oh, yeah. I don't get recognized in H Mart very often. And actually, like, the only time I've wanted to, like, bust out any, like, celebrity cred is, like, when, like, the security guard at the, like, East Village location was, like, really mean to me. And I wanted, like, I couldn't figure out how to put the, like, basket in the cart. And he was, like, really mean about it. And I wanted to be like, do you know who I am?
You should have, like, pointed to the monitor.
Yeah, because
they have that video.
They don't
here,
have
right?
them there. That's probably why.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Even when I did that, though, I was, like, checking out at, like, a register. And I was like, oh, that's me. The Ajumma was really just like, I don't care.
Yeah.
Take your rice and go.
So the book grew out of an essay you wrote for The New Yorker. Thank you, and you're also welcome. So I'm just curious, like, when you finish the book and the book comes out, like, how did you change over the course of writing it, if you feel like you did?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you had this experience, but I mean, I think that writing memoir really forces you to have like some radical compassion for people that you may or may not feel ready to have or like want to have, you know? I mean, there is a first version of this book that was so angry at my dad and at myself and at every person in my life. And, you know, one really beautiful thing about writing a book is that it takes so much time and it forces you to have so much perspective. You know, when I submitted the rough draft, I didn't get it back for 3 or 4 months. So when I reread it, I think I didn't realize I was so angry and how much I was holding in and how much I really needed to let go if I wanted to tell this story honestly and fairly. And so I think I was able to see you know, other perspectives a bit more clearly and find a lot of forgiveness for myself and the people that were involved in this very difficult time in all of our lives.
You know, I'm wondering, like, how did your relationship to your mother change after you finished writing this?
I feel like I have a deeper understanding of her. I don't know if you've, I mean, I know you don't want to talk about Stage True, but I had such a wonderful, I mean, I'm talking to a Pulitzer winning writer right now, who has an amazing memoir called Stay True, and I read it this week and enjoyed it so much. And, you know, it's impossible to not think about how very similar they are and also how very different. One thing I thought was sort of interesting was, you know, the first line of my book is, "Ever since my mom died, I cry in H-Mart." And so much of your book is really not mentioned until, I mean, it's a discovery that sort of happens that your friend has died, and it's sort of towards like the end of, not, I don't think that's spoiling anything, but it's sort of towards the end of the book, and it's interesting to see how differently we handled grief and sharing the story of loss. But for me personally, it was such a joy to kind of try to see things from my mother's side and share parts of her. And I think part of the joy of being a writer is like being a sort of detective and unraveling parts of their person. And I think I learned so much more deeper understanding, and I felt much closer to her after writing the book.
That's beautiful. I mean, I think that, you know, you are a detective. You're also sort of like a time traveler. Like, you can sort of go back and relive things that you may not have appreciated the first time around.
And I also think it was like proof that I really loved this person, because my mom and I had such a tumultuous relationship that I almost felt like I needed to get the facts straight that we really loved each other. It was just complicated, and I felt this need to prove that. And I feel like, you know, towards the end of the book, you also kind of confront that, where you're like, were we really as close as I thought we were? And you're sort of like convincing yourself and exploring this relationship and all of its complexities and validating for yourself of like, yeah, we did really love each other. We were really connected and close. And I think that was a part of that writing process as well.
So, you know, one thing that I talked to you about a year and a half ago, I think. And at the time, you were working on adapting your memoir for the screen. Is there anything you can share about sort of like your approach or how you're going to think about doing it?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I, you know, didn't write very much about in the book was, you know, my musical life. And I just love, I mean, that was such a big part of my teenage years, was like that sort of discovery. And I think also towards the end of the book, I sort of began to realize, you know, I didn't want anyone to get confused that this was like, you know, this is how it became Shell's Honor of Japanese Breakfast. Like, I'm not like Keith Richards or something. But I really like avoided writing too much about it until I realized like that was a really big part of my, you know, major rift with my mother. It was a really big part of our relationship. And when we sort of started to argue with one another, was this like this calling I felt I had and this real passion that she was so confused by and so against. And, you know, it's just such a different craft. It's really funny. You have to find, like, I started compiling a list of like adverbs, because you have to like describe, you know, leaving a room or smiling or looking at someone in like so many different ways. And you have to be really smart and short about it. And it's almost like there's this kind of like ad agency like lingo. So it's quite different.
So there was this moment, I don't know if it was, I've lost complete track of like the last 2 years, but there was this moment where you perform with Karen O.
Yeah.
And also the Linda Lindas.
Yeah.
And you posted this like incredibly like moving note where you talked about sort of Karen O's role in sort of like being able to understand yourself and see yourself. I do feel like it is like a generational thing where it does seem like a lot of younger artists, particularly in this AAPI space, are kind of looking out for each other in a way that may not have been as obvious in the 80s or 90s when there was like more competition.
I was really lucky and so much of my career was assisted by Mitski, who took me on tour in 2016. And it was really cool to have, you know, at the time, like she was like the hot Asian girl in indie, and like she could have like really like coveted that position and not wanted to like share. And I feel like one thing that's really cool about our generation is that like we've really started to dissect that like internalized misogyny and racism and try to like lend a helping hand, whereas like maybe even in the 90s like they would pit women against each other, and it would be hard not to kind of believe that. And it's really nice now. I feel like we have such a wonderful community where like we're really helping each other and are trying to push for you know, bringing each other on tour and sharing each other's work and supportive, having like a supportive network with one another. And so I try to take part in that.
That's awesome. You're moving soon.
Yeah, so I'm moving to Korea to live for a year and work on my second book, where I am going to study the language and document that process. And I think it was such a natural response to writing a book that was so rooted in the past, and so much of what was hard about it was like, it was so obviously emotional, but also, you know, it was hard to remember all of that. So I'm really looking forward to writing about, you know, the day-to-day experience of living in another country and learning a language. Yeah, I guess like the thing I'm most worried about is just like being too dumb to learn. Because I've gone to Koreans. I never like cared enough about it until, you know, you get older and you like start paying for school and tutors yourself. But and I'm really curious like how it will go to be fully immersed and have my one job to be a student. And I'm most excited to just be completely consumed by one thing. I just want to do one thing and to like go to school and focus on one skill.
Wait, you're going to be an actual like student?
Yeah, I'm going to go to classes, and I'm most excited to like live in a city where people have manners. Because I think that, you know, our country is getting out of hand. I'm so looking forward to everyone standing to one side of the escalator.
Yeah.
That is what I'm like most excited about. And the idea of like someone not watching a video on their phone on the subway without headphones. Like there's no way anyone in Korea is doing that. And I'm looking forward to never being around that for a full year.
That does sound great. That's all we have time for. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Michelle Zauner is the author of Crying in H Mart and leads the band Japanese Breakfast. She spoke with Hua Xu. Hua's memoir is called Stay True, and you can read him on all manner of things at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining me this hour. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Adam Howard, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, and Louis Mitchell, with guidance from Emily Botin and assistance from Mike Kutchman, Michael May, David Gable, and Alejandra Deckett. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.